Akatra Foundation presents the Akatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome back to the Akatra Dialogue. Today we're taking a deep dive into an absolutely extraordinary life and a really monumental book, Nelson Mandela's autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom. Our mission here is to, really unpack the incredible journey of a man who didn't just witness history, he actively reshaped it. We want to pull out the most vital bits of wisdom, the key insights from his own words. Think of it as your shortcut to understanding what it truly takes to lead, to endure just unimaginable hardship, and maybe the toughest part, to forgive.
Yeah, and what's so fascinating about this book, Long Walk to Freedom, is how Mandela's very personal story becomes something universal. It's not just, you know, a history lesson about South Africa.
Right.
It's this profound testament to human resilience and the incredibly long, hard journey towards real freedom, not just for one person, but for a whole society. And it really makes you ask, doesn't it? What does true freedom actually mean? And maybe more pointedly, what are we as individuals, as communities, what are we really willing to sacrifice for it?
That's a powerful question to start with.
Okay.
Let's unpack this incredible figure then.
Yeah.
Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela, born 1918, rural village, South Africa's Eastern Cape. What was it about his background, his early life, that sort of set him up to become this pivotal figure?
Well, I think it's this dual background he had, which is quite unique. On one hand, he's born into the Thembu royal family. So he gets this very traditional African upbringing steeped in, you know, the customs, the ways of governing of his people.
Yep.
But then he also pursues a Western education, goes on to get legal training, becomes one of South Africa's very first black lawyers. So he has this blend.
All right, both sides.
Exactly. He gets the traditional leadership understanding and the modern legal framework.
Okay.
And his credentials, they're astounding, really. A founding member of the ANC Youth League back in 1944. Then, nearly three decades in prison, which made him this global symbol against apartheid. And then, of course, leading South Africa as its first democratically elected president.
Incredible journey.
It really is. He wasn't just watching from the sidelines. He was right in the thick of it, from grassroots organizing all the way up to being a statesman. So when he reflects, it just carries this incredible weight, this authority, because he lived it, every single bit of it.
So the long walk, it starts not in those later famous places, the courtroom, the prison cell, but way back, that small village, Kwanu. Yeah. What did he learn there? What were those formative years like?
Well, his childhood in Kwanu was deeply rooted in Thembu customs, as I mentioned. His birth name, Rolihlahla, which is interesting. It apparently translates roughly to pulling the branch of a tree, or maybe more pointedly, troublemaker.
Huh. Prophetic, maybe.
You could say that, yeah. The name Nelson, that came later, given by a teacher on his first day of school, which was apparently quite common then. But a really key part of his upbringing was being raised by Chief Jungtaba Delinjebo at the Great Place in Mekwekezwini. He was immersed in traditional African governance there.
Okay. What did that involve?
A lot of emphasis on Indaba. It's this process of open discussion, consensus building. Everyone gets heard. Decisions are made collectively. It taught him profoundly about leadership through listening, through negotiation, and just how vital unity is in a community.
That's a really strong foundation. But then, like you said, things shift dramatically. He leaves that rural world and gets thrown into Johannesburg. What prompted that move, and what was that like, that awakening?
Well, initially, he actually fled to Johannesburg to escape an arranged marriage.
Really? Show some independence early on.
It does. But once he gets there, that's when he really comes face to face with the raw systemic racism, the brutal segregation of urban South Africa under apartheid. For listeners maybe less familiar, apartheid was this deeply institutionalized system of racial segregation and discrimination.
Yeah.
Enforced from 48 right up to the early 90s.
Just baked into everything.
Absolutely. And his experience there, it just solidified his understanding. He saw that these weren't just, you know, random acts of prejudice. No, this was a deliberate system, meticulously built to oppress.
And what an awakening that must have been.
Yeah.
You read about him working as a mine security guard. Quite a contrast to that royal upbringing.
Huge contrast.
While also studying law at Wits University.
Uh-huh.
And it's there, in that bustling city, surrounded by all that intellectual energy, that he really finds his political voice. Influenced by figures like Walter Sisulu, Oliver Tambo.
Lifelong mentors and comrades, yeah.
It really sounds like a crucible, that period, forging his political consciousness. Okay, so here's where the Long Walk chronicles a really dramatic and, I imagine, incredibly difficult shift. Mandela starts out as a lawyer, someone working within the system, initially hoping for reform. But the book details this profound evolution. What was it that ultimately pushed him and the ANC away from peaceful petitions towards, well, armed resistance?
That's such a crucial question, isn't it? And his reflections on this are, I think, some of the most revealing in the book. His rise within the ANC Youth League back in 44, that was definitely a catalyst.
Right, the younger generation pushing things.
Exactly. They felt the older ANC leadership was maybe too cautious. They wanted more confrontational mass action. He talks about key campaigns like the Defiance Campaign in 52 against those unjust apartheid laws, deliberately breaking discriminatory laws, facing arrests.
Civil disobedience on a mass scale.
Precisely. And then the drafting of the Freedom Charter in 1955, which laid out this vision for a non-racial democratic South Africa. And during this time, remember, he and Oliver Tambo even set up the first black-run law firm in the country.
Still trying to use the legal system.
Still trying. Trying to fight it legally through every channel they could find.
So they're pushing boundaries non-violently, but still hoping for dialogue.
Yeah.
What was the absolute breaking point then? What tipped the scales?
Sharpeville. The Sharpeville Massacre in 1960. That was the definitive turning point. Police just opened fire on this crowd of unarmed black South Africans protesting the past laws, killed 69 people, wounded many more.
Horrific.
It was. And Mandela describes this crushing realization hitting him. Nonviolent protest, no matter how peaceful, how principled, was just being met with lethal, unrestrained force by the state. He concluded that the state's brutality basically made peaceful options futile.
Yeah.
And it raises that really difficult universal question, doesn't it? What options do people have when every single peaceful avenue is met with violence and just shut down completely? For Mandela, it forced this profound moral and strategic recalculation.
And that's what led directly to forming Umkhonto we Sizwe-MK, the Spear of the Nation, the armed wing of the ANC, an incredibly difficult decision, surely.
Hugely difficult. And he went underground to organize it, earning that nickname, the Black Pimpernel, because he was so good at evading the police. He even secretly left the country for military training to try and get international support. It was a whole new, much more dangerous phase.
The book must convey the gravity of that decision.
Oh, absolutely. It wasn't taken lightly at all. There was immense debate within the ANC. It was a strategic shift, yes, but really born out of desperation, a feeling that they'd genuinely exhausted all other options. Mandela felt strongly, if the government rules by force, the people ultimately have no choice but to respond with force.
And that period leads eventually to the Rivonia trial, 1963 to 64, and that incredible 4-hour speech from the dock, ending with those famous words, I have fought against white domination and I have fought against black domination. It is an ideal which I hope to live for and to achieve, but if needs be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die.
What's the impact of him saying that right there in court? Oh, it was huge. Far more than just a legal defense. It was this profound moral political statement to the entire world, laying bare the injustice of apartheid, but also clearly articulating the ANC's vision, democratic, non-racial South Africa.
So it wasn't just about his own freedom?
Not at all. It was about the freedom of his people. And that statement, it just resonated globally. It really transformed him from, you know, a relatively known local activist into this powerful international symbol of resistance against oppression. And it cemented this image of him as a man of just unwavering principle, ready to pay the ultimate price.
And then after Rivonia comes the ultimate test. 27 years. 27 long years in prison. The heart of the book, really, is his time on Robben Island, that notorious prison. What was that like, and how on earth did he and others manage to maintain hope, purpose, even grow in those conditions?
The conditions were just brutal. Hard labor, breaking rocks in a lime quarry, meager food rations, constant harassment from guards, deep isolation, especially early on. He describes the physical toll, the cold, the hunger.
Unimaginable.
Truly. But what's so incredible is how he and the other political prisoners just refused to be broken. They turned Robben Island into what they called the University of Robben Island.
The university, how did that work?
They organized secret political education classes, shared knowledge history, economics, literature, languages. They maintained strict discipline amongst themselves, kept their ANC command structures alive somehow. It was this incredible act of defiance, using their minds, their moral strength, to resist being dehumanized.
That's just an amazing testament to the human spirit, turning a place meant to break you into a place of learning.
Yeah.
But you mentioned growth. The book suggests it wasn't just resistance, but an inner transformation too.
Absolutely. Because even in those incredibly restrictive circumstances, Mandela used education not just as defiance, but as a tool for strategic growth. He painstakingly learned Afrikaans,
the language of the oppressor.
Exactly. And started studying the history, the culture of his enemies, not to, you know, appease them, but to understand them. And this sparked a really profound internal shift, moving away from purely focusing on resistance towards thinking long term about negotiation, about reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
He started to realize that true, lasting peace probably couldn't just be won militarily. It would have to be forged through dialogue, even with the very people who'd imprisoned him. That period really shows him evolving from just the freedom fighter to the statesman, preparing for the huge complexities of eventual governance.
So after decades locked away, the almost unthinkable starts to happen. Secret talks, negotiations with the very government that put him there.
Yeah.
How did Mandela, still technically a prisoner, navigate that? It sounds incredibly delicate, high stakes.
It was an extraordinary balancing act. The book really details the immense psychological, political tightrope he had to walk. He gets transferred first to Polsmoor Prison, then Victor Verster. And these secret overtures begin from government officials P.W. Botha initially, then later F.W. de Klerk. Mandela had to, well, painstakingly build some level of trust with his captors, engage them in dialogue. But at the same time, he had to reassure his comrades in the ANC, many still underground or in exile, that he wasn't compromising, that he wasn't selling out the struggle. Think about it. A prisoner negotiating with his jailers, essentially leading the movement from inside a prison cell.
That must have caused incredible tension within the movement itself.
Yeah.
How did he manage that? What were his absolute bottom line?
Yeah, huge tensions. And if you connect this to the bigger picture, it just shows his immense skill. As a strategist, a negotiator, but also a unifier, his core principles were absolute, crystal clear, non-negotiable: the unconditional unbanning of the ANC, the release of all political prisoners, and an unwavering commitment to a non-racial, democratic South Africa.
No compromise on those.
None. He never wavered on those. But crucially, he understood that real peace, lasting peace, could only come through dialogue, not through total victory or revenge. He truly grasped that you had to engage the enemy, understand their fears, their perspectives, not just aim to defeat them. He saw the future, however difficult, not as victor and vanquished, but somehow as partners building a new nation.
February 11, 1990, he walks out of Victor Verster prison. What a moment. The whole world is watching. But the book makes it so clear, doesn't it? His long walk wasn't over. Not by long shot. What were those challenges like, leading a nation trying to emerge from apartheid? A nation so deeply scarred?
Oh, it was overwhelming. For him, for the country, the initial euphoria of his release, it very quickly gave way to this incredibly turbulent, often violent transition period.
Right. It wasn't smooth sailing.
Not at all. There were intense negotiations. CODESA, the Convention for a Democratic South Africa, trying to get all these different parties, including the old apartheid government and the ANC, to agree on a path forward, draft a new constitution. His presidency itself from 94 to 99 was obviously monumental, but just fraught with challenges. The country teetered on the brink of civil war several times.
Really?
Yes. And the task of trying to heal those deep racial divisions, address the massive economic inequalities left by apartheid, build democratic institutions basically from scratch, it was immense, just a myth.
Really sounds like ending apartheid was just the first, maybe even the easiest step on an even longer, much more complicated road.
Exactly. And this brings up that important question again about what true freedom really means. Mm-hmm. Mandela argued so passionately that freedom isn't just, you know, the absence of oppression. It's not just casting off chains.
That's more than that.
It's the positive presence of dignity, of equality, of opportunity for everyone. His work setting up the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, for instance. That was a profound attempt to heal the wounds of the past without falling into a cycle of revenge, trying to get to the truth of what happened under apartheid.
Acknowledging the pain.
Acknowledging the truth, yes. And his famous reflection that the long walk is not yet over, that speaks volumes. It tells us it's this continuous struggle, freedom from poverty, from inequality, from racism, from injustice. That fight continues even after you achieve political liberation. Political change is often just the beginning, you know, the start of a much deeper societal transformation.
So let's bring it back to our listener. What does all this mean for you? Mandela's life, his long walk, it offers these incredibly profound insights that go way beyond South Africa. As we wrap up this deep dive, what are some of the most powerful, specific takeaways for our own lives, our own challenges, personal, professional, maybe societal?
There are so many, really. But a few critical lessons definitely emerge from the unique fire of his experience. First, I'd say, is about moral leadership and courage. He taught us, famously, the brave man is not he who does not feel afraid, but he who conquers that fear. Mm-hmm. His courage wasn't just like a sudden lack of fear. It was the sustained, conscious choice to act despite immense fear, to lead, to keep people unified, diverse, often fractured groups for decades under unimaginable pressure. His courage was rooted in this unwavering long-term vision, even when everything looked dark. It shows us that real courage is about persistence, about purpose, even when you're absolutely terrified.
It's such a powerful distinction, isn't it? Not the absence of fear, but acting anyway. Okay, what else really stands out?
Then there's reconciliation and empathy. That famous quote, "No one is born hating another person. If they can learn to hate, they can be taught to love, for love comes more naturally to the human heart than its opposite." Now, this wasn't some, you know, naive, wishful thinking.
No, it feels strategic, almost.
It was a profound strategic choice. It really forces us to think about the immense difficulty, but also the power of trying to understand your adversaries.
Yeah.
Of choosing forgiveness over revenge. Not just because it's morally good, but as a practical path to lasting peace. Whether that's in huge community conflicts or even just in our own personal relationships. It's about genuinely trying to bridge divides, not just score points or win arguments.
That feels incredibly relevant today. And what about freedom itself?
Yes. The third big one is understanding the nature of true freedom and our collective responsibility. He put it so well. To be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others.
Ah, so it's not just about me.
Exactly. It goes way beyond just individual liberty. It connects directly to how our actions, yours and mine, contribute to a more just society. Mm. It emphasizes our interconnectedness, what's often referred to by the Xhosa term Ubuntu.
Ubuntu, I've heard that.
Yeah, often translated as "I am because we are." It's this deep philosophy that our humanity is shaped by our relationships, by our community. So basically, my freedom is incomplete if you or others around us aren't also free. We're tied together.
That's a profound challenge to individualism. And finally, something we touched on earlier, his commitment to learning.
Absolutely. That's maybe the fourth key takeaway. The importance of education and resilience. You see it right through his life, from the University of Robben Island to just his lifelong pursuit of learning. Mandela showed again and again that education is such a powerful weapon. For change, yes, but also for self-development. It's a lifelong journey that builds our capacity to make a positive impact, to adapt our thinking, our strategies, and crucially, to hold on to our moral compass, even when facing the absolute worst. He never stopped learning, and that's partly what allowed him to evolve so profoundly as a leader.
Nelson Mandela's long walk to freedom. It really isn't just a historical document, is it? It feels more like a timeless meditation on our human capacity for growth, for forgiveness, for incredible transformation. It's just such a powerful reminder that massive change is often driven by individuals making extraordinary moral and strategic choices, often at huge personal cost.
It really is. And the book demonstrates that even though the path to justice is incredibly long, incredibly difficult, it is possible for people to hold on to their humanity while fighting in human systems. It shows us that you can emerge from even the most bitter struggles with your capacity for compassion, for reconciliation, still intact. So as you, our listener, reflect on Mandela's long walk, maybe consider this. In your own life, in your own context today, what steps, big or small, are you taking to contribute to a world where genuine equality, dignity, opportunity are present for everyone? What does that long walk to freedom mean for you right now?
A powerful thought to end on. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the extraordinary life of Nelson Mandela through his own words. We really hope it's given you much to think about and maybe even inspired you on your own long walk. Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by the Decatra Foundation.